Yes, it's all right. Today it's October the 16th. Let's start. Now, if you remember, the last time we spoke quite at length about what you called critics, your critics and your enemies.
Oh, yes. Well, it was a very boring thing.
And it was, yes. Well, and
I remember the name of it. Periodical.
Yeah, I was sure that it will
come back.
Persecute you.
Salmagundi.
Salmagundi.
S-A-L-M-A.
S-A-L-M-A-G-U-N-D-I.
Yeah. I don't know what it means.
By the way, did I leave at your in Albany the bibliography? I have a copy of your.
Yes, you have. Yeah. No, in Headington. I meant to bring it, yes.
No, I
meant to bring it. I put it on the sofa next to where you sit.
Yes.
But then I forgot you were coming here.
It's all right.
It's there. It is there. I found it.
And, I mean, you mentioned names, partly critics, partly just critics,
yes.
Partly what you called enemies.
Well, people are make personal,
yes,
personal attacks.
A
personal attacks, yes. Not just a disagreement.
And you insisted on trying to remember everyone, because I thought that you, relatively speaking, met
good press.
Life, a few.
Good press.
And you said that there are more than I thought. And you tried to pick up every name. And
everyone remembers, you see. And I don't remember everyone.
Yeah.
Aline reminded me of some more that I've forgotten by now.
Yeah. Now, I remember you mentioned Popper for a short while after your lecture on inevitability in history.
He complained when I
complained you didn't
acknowledge his influence.
But it was not in writing.
No.
And then, of course, after Marx, you had Raymond Postgate and others. And I dare say
communists attacked
that the majority of your critics were left-wingers.
Always are.
Yes.
Always have been.
Yes.
Except for historical inevitability. That was attacked on both sides.
Yes. Catholics like Dawson.
Yes. And Spectator, some men.
Or even Bernard.
Some men, the Spectator. What's his name? I remember. But it wasn't an enemy. Just to tell you, that's ordinary attack. I don't count it. A man called, he's now in Washington as a correspondent. I've forgotten his name, yes. Fairley. Henry Fairley.
Fairley is an intelligent man. Henry
Fairley. Yes, he attacked it.
Ah, I didn't remember.
Yeah.
I should have.
I
like his
writing. In the Spectator. Yes.
He used to write for Encounter, too.
Absolutely. But he's a right-wing writer.
Yes. Any
yes, he is. Quite sharp. Henry Fairley, yes.
And I was surprised that you said that nobody defended you in this argument about inevitability in history.
Nobody.
I mean, not personal.
No. Intellectual issue.
Yes.
Not a question of personalities.
I mean, after all, there are so many. Who
no, there aren't so many.
Who was the one who Look. Asked you, is there really anybody who seriously believes in determinism?
Austin.
Austin. So, and he's right.
Well, of course, I mean, he's right.
But
nobody is allowed. 95% of philosophers are theoretically determinists.
Theoretically.
Yes. Theoretically. I mean, they would say they were. Because causality and science, how can one not be? Otherwise the world is a chaos. What do we explain? We can only explain if there are causes, like EHK. Everything has a cause, self-evident. Anyone who doesn't believe that is a little mad. I mean, that's the view. It's a little mad. It's like saying black is white. We all know that even all events have causes and they have causes. I mean, it's a platitude. So, not very, no. There are indeterminists. There are such philosophers. Very, very few. Among the famous ones, I think the only famous ones would be Epicurus, from whom it begins. All determinism begins from the Stoics. And all indeterminism begins from the Epicurus. Kant is an indeterminist. He is the greatest and most important. It doesn't very well argue that it's a well, I can mention names here, but they're all terribly, well, like William James, Renouvier, who reads Renouvier in the English-speaking countries? William James did. John Stuart Mill had a nervous breakdown practically on this issue, but he decided self-determination was all right. If your character determines it, not just forces pushing from outside, then you are free. Can't call that a miserable subterfuge. That very argument. It begins with the Stoics. Cleanthes. Let me see. Who else is an indeterminist? A man called Campbell, somewhere in Scotland, completely forgotten figure. Yes.
Any historian came to your defense?
No.
No. But I'm sure you met historians here. I mean, the historians here.
Historians don't know anything about it. They don't know anything about it. Historians are not interested in philosophy.
But the argument is not only philosophical. As an historical method or attitude, I believe that
most historians do not behave as if they were determinists, but they don't know it.
You really think so? I mean,
I've never known of a historian who defend who attacked the notion of rigid determinism. Fisher wrote a book, was not a great historian. In the preface, he said, fortunate are those who see pattern in history. I'm not so fortunate. For me, history is largely the interplay of the accidental and the unforeseen. Well, he was attacked viciously by Marxists, immediately, in the 30s. He was Christopher Hill's chief target.
All right, Christopher Hill, but Christopher Hill is not the mainstream of
England. He had considerable influence in England. In England, very influential.
Influential, yes. But he's a Marxist.
Well, all right, yes, of course he is. But now tell me, who are the historians of England?
I mean, let's
who take an interest? And Trevor Roper probably is not a determinist.
Surely not.
No, he doesn't come out with it, but he's not. Trevor Roper is on my side.
I'm sure.
He doesn't offend me by name.
All right.
But the last lecture, it's quite true, his Romanes lecture, delivered 2 years ago, is a defense of indeterminism, to some extent. Correct.
And in his writing, he's not a determinist.
No, absolutely. But that really was you're right. Yeah. That was, in a way, a formal statement about that. Yes. Trevor Roper, certainly. H.P. Taylor knows nothing about it. Doesn't think in abstract terms at all.
Though in his writings, he's not a determinist.
He does not have anything with theory. Nothing to do with ideas. He hates ideas. H.P. Taylor. That's why his books are old-fashioned political history. Nothing about economics, nothing about social history, nothing about history of ideas. Rigidly confined to political history of the most pre-Marxist type. So a paradox.
But you see, let's say a man like myself, I didn't deal with ideas. I'm not an expert of ideas.
No, but it's
I'm
All Jews are into the ideas. All Jews are into them.
But name. I am anti-determinist.
Nehemiah, I don't know whether Nehemiah was or was not. He didn't want to discuss it. I'm sure he wasn't, but he wouldn't take a position about it. He thought it was all metaphysics and, well, not interested in the presuppositions of history. The philosophical aspects were of no interest to him. I told you the story. I sent him this essay. Yes, it's certainly very funny. It's in my book. It's in my introduction. It is in the book. He wrote back and saying, you must be a very intelligent man, very, very intelligent man, to be able to understand what you write.
Yes.
That is about that essay.
Yeah. But you see,
contempt for
yes.
And abstractions and philosophy and that kind of nonsense.
I know. So, I mean, I can see his criticism of your trying to deal with it as a concept.
The old issue is irrelevant.
But in his writings, as an historian...
Yes, of course, but that is true of most historians. But they have no idea. They don't know. Because like people talk prose without knowing it. Like Mary Molière.
Would expect them to welcome...
No.
This conceptual...
No, they can't think. They can't think in abstract terms.
Don't tell me they, tell me you, because I'm also an historian.
No, I know, but Jews are exceptional in this regard. Jews are interested in method. Boyum are not, by and large.
Particularly British historians are not.
Well, not his ideas at all. But even in France, you see, all these Brodels are determinists. You see, the whole Ecole, the whole Annales is very determinist.
That's why I'm trying to fight them.
Yeah, but Annales is very impersonal factors.
It's too fashionable now, Brodel.
It's a little bit dying off, but because they're all dead, but let me try and think. German stories, I don't know. Nobody says that Hitler was inevitable. That they don't like to say. Well, Russian historians, who are American historians, for the most part, they don't know who they are. They also don't bother about ideas.
I'm sure that the younger generation is more interested in ideas, but I'm not familiar with the writings. I mean, the Americans...
My friend Morton White, who is a philosopher of history, he's a strict determinist.
I can see why many philosophers of history...
Because it's clear and scientific rush. It's a form of rationalism. If you do abandon that, then you're taking in some mystical... Absolutely.
I can see why psychologically there are types that can't live without such an... Anchor.
But look, the business of history is to explain. To state, all right, narrative, all right, that... The business of historians is to establish facts that is done by scientific means of probability, like a detective. Though you certainly use some kind of determinist premises. Moreover, to explain, explanation is causal explanation. There is no other for them. And that's what explanation means. If it means that, in physics it means that for us. That's what it comes from. Indeed, that's what I said in that. Yes, that's what annoyed people.
Now, coming back to the list of your critics and enemies, did you mention Sidney Morgenbesser writing, arguing with you? Or the critics?
No. Well, we argued about something, but not this.
But not in writing. I mean, yes.
He doesn't write anything.
Yes. And all in all, I mean, this group, Let's call them the Macphersonians. I don't know, Chuck Taylor.
Yeah, yes, that's not the same.
I know, but generally speaking, it's a different school and a different generation coming to Oxford.
Yes, yes.
How was your meeting?
Oh, very friendly.
The intellectual one.
Very friendly. We never, I don't think we argued. Jenny Cohen was a pupil of mine. I taught him. Marx and Hegel. He did with me in your college, because his teacher was Ryle, who was...
But he was a Marxist, Robert.
Oh, yes. But he was a very... In no degree. At no point. We personally got on so well. He knew perfectly what I wasn't. But he enjoys argument. He enjoys talking. He's got a very open mind. And now, of course, he's rather diluted Marxism. He doesn't know where he is. But in my case... He just enjoyed discussing the points. I never, for one single moment, came across any kind of resentment or opposition.
He was not going to be shaken.
No way. And the same with Taylor, I've never argued. Well, yes, Taylor. Taylor came to my lectures on the history of idea of political thought and disagreed with me. When I got to Marx, he thought I was totally wrong. But he went. He came. Then I had a class with him. That we disagreed, but in the most polite possible terms. I had a fanatical Marxist, with a brother called Allman, who is a professor in New York. No, he wouldn't, but he's a fanatical Trotskyite, more or less, who I had to supervise. We had terrible arguments, but our personal relations remained so good that it never came. Let me tell you a story now. I was invited to talk in New York at some symposium, annual thing arranged by a man called Melvin Richter, who is a political scientist in New York, he was also here and so on, wrote a book on T.H. Green. And this was the middle of the student uprising. 68, must be 69, I don't know, that kind of place. And it happened in a large hall in the city university, which is a large hall. And the speakers are going to be Charles Taylor and myself. Maybe there's nobody else. It was a huge argument with two people. Can't remember the third person, but I rather doubt it. It was obviously going to be liberalism versus Marxism in some way. Well, we were great friends, so we weren't going to be disagreeable to each other clearly. But the man who presided was a man who's now dead. He was a Jewish historian right there somewhere in Syracuse or in, I don't know, Columbus. I can't remember his name. Already by then in New York. Large fat man with a political rather nice. He was very nervous that in my case there may be an outbreak on the part of the students because I was not fashionable at that moment. So he made elaborate arrangements for I was to escape. If there was going to be an explosion of gas, I was to use a wet handkerchief which they provide against my nose to solve. And there's this door through which we're all going to go. I mean, tremendous precautionary measures were taken about the eventuality. Well, they all turned up. And there were two of my pupils in the audience. One was called Holman. He's a man who wrote a book called Famous Game in New York, which you lost money at first he made, then he lost, called, I think, something like Capitalist System. Marxists versus Capitalists. That was a game like Attack with various pieces, which you invest money, you lose it, you exploit. Loud picture of Marx and Rockefeller on the cover. He's still there, and he wasn't alive and so on. He's an active Marxist propagandist.
Holman.
O-double-L-M-A-N.
Who was previously a student.
Certainly. I supervised him. After 6 years, we managed to pull him through. After the change of examiners occurred, he was referred. It was agony, but in the end, Charles Taylor helped, I helped, and so on. He was the son of a tram driver in Wisconsin, unusual for Jews, for some beer company. You see, he got a second at PPE in Mordlin, and they thought he was no good at all. But he came to me, asked to come to me, and personally got on very well. He met a girl in the tube who was French. He rather liked her looks. He followed her, proposed to her, and married her. And he's still married to her. It's something unusual. Luke knows him very well. We had to testify for him when he was off the job in, I think, Maryland and was prevented by the governor from holding it because he was a Marxist propagandist. He never did suit all kinds of horror that occurred. Anyway, he was there. Then there was a man called Marshall Berman, who is also a rather brilliant writer. Very neurotic, difficult boy. Not entirely nice, but also supervised by me. Extreme left-wing. And part of all that, and rather violent, rather, and he wanted to be a kind of Daniel LaRouge, kind of Cohn Bendit. I don't know if Peter told you that Cohn Bendit appeared in the book fair in Frankfurt with somebody else, I can't remember. He was perfectly mild. Yes, he had some job there. And no, Cohn Bendit and Peter were both had to do something. Their names occurred together somehow. Quite funny idea. With Tusk in the museum. Anyway, there were these two people in the audience, a very large audience. I made my liberal statement without, I didn't hear anything. First of all, I think Taylor spoke first. I spoke first. You made my points. Quite sharply, as I always do. Perhaps a slight exaggeration. And somebody got up and began to barrack me, try to oppose me. At this point, my two people got up. They were very well known. And defended me to the, I can't tell you, somebody displayed extreme loyalty. And they obviously passed the word, but on no account was anything critical to be said about me. Very unexpected. The chairman could knock him over the feather. Couldn't understand what was happening at all. You see, complete dire silence. People got up, agreed, disagreed. Wasn't a single crossword. No word against you was spoken. I was a friend. I was a decent person. I was protected.
Did you have in this
case? I always felt if there was a revolution, I would escape.
Yes, you have your...
My Hasidim,
Did you have your personal troubles in those days, in 68, 69, 70?
No. The opposite. I was President Wilson at that period. I became President Wilson in 60... When did I become 65, I think? 66.
But the college didn't exist.
No, but it was lived in sort of houses in Banbury Road. It existed. Didn't have a building.
Yes, the building
did. No, yes. 66, I think.
When I was...
66 or 75. I was there 9 years. You were here when?
No. When I came to Portofino in 1969 or 70... You were building the college.
That's right. That's right. Very good. Quite so. Now, when the riots broke out in Oxford, the first riots broke out in Oriel. Trevor Roper was the chief butt. You can imagine. Then Regis Fraser. And then it spread. And we had in Wolfson quite three or four young, very left-wing young men. One was a man called Chanan, C-H-A-N-A-N, who went to the Jewish public school. What's it called?
Carmel.
And revolted against it in a major way. And he was one of the ringleaders, but the ringleader was a man whose name was Freeman. He was a computer mathematician, very quiet, very gentle, rather sort of holy look, and he talked to 2,000 students, or 3,000 at a time. He was the official head of the entire class. Very much listened to. He became a kind of guru, kind of saint of the movement. He was a graduate student at Wolfson. Why was he a graduate student there? I would have taken him anyway. The vice-chancellor of Edinburgh was a man called Swan. Never in his testimonial told us that he had the slightest left-wing deviation. He could have said his old strong political view was something. Not a word. Nothing. It's completely concealed. He already led marches in Edinburgh. He gave him terrible trouble. Nothing. Glad to get rid of him. I didn't think that was entirely honorable. I think it would have been terrible if we'd not taken him. But at least we ought to have known. Obviously, it was not easy. He wasn't very good. He wasn't very bad. Quite decent. Now, he, of course, led the revolution. But in Wolfson, he had no objection to anything. It's exactly what he wanted. That was the point. The point was Wolfson ideal. No high table. Complete... equal relations between fellows and graduates. A thing called the college, I don't know what it's called, there was a meeting of the governing body, but there was also a thing called the, not college assembly, I've forgotten what his name was, something like a college meeting, to which everybody came. And even the cook was made a member. You see, that sort of thing. They never came, but there's a piece of democracy. And everybody, all the the Dallas Keller graduates came, everything was discussed, they made recommendations, and for some funny reason, until right at the end, I'll tell you in a moment, none of the demands were ever refused. They were quite reasonable. Once there was no increase of temperature, you see, the sort of things they said were never extended. They didn't demand anything impossible. It was very loose texture. We didn't have a building. It was all very friendly. And the point is that Fremont thought it was perfect. We found any other place for university like that, we'd have no objection. So, in some mysterious, Bullock was then vice chancellor. He was one of them, there were two. He was succeeded by, I think, Habakkuk. They both got into trouble with the students. Bullock wanted to free him. He said, what happened was, there was an attack on the clerks in the Sheldonia. There was another one in the of the women, the secretaries in the Indian Institute. I can't know which one, but mainly the Sheldonian. Freeman wasn't in Oxford. He was in Southampton that day. But he came back to say if he had been in Oxford, he would have been with the attackers. He's, so to speak, expressed solidarity. Bullock telephoned to me and said, I want to send him down. No question, he must be sent down. I can't have that. Would the college, would you agree? Would your college agree to the sending down? I said, no. As far as the college is concerned, he's absolutely peaceful. We've got no objection to him. He's not done a single thing which we can object to. If the university sends him down, we can't help it. You can do it if you like. We will not help. We cannot send a document expressing disapproval. You see, because we're not a university's university. College is college. From our point of view, he's an admirable citizen. I'm sorry to have to say it. It is so. He was not sent out. He disappeared and has not never been heard of since.
Really?
No. He became some sort of computerist somewhere in Scotland. And he's probably, I don't know, God knows what he's doing. Never. Disappeared totally. Just like the man in California who started the whole thing in Berkeley. The rebellion started in Berkeley. With a man with an Italian name. Who then came to St. Catharines. I don't think it was under Bullock or not. Must have been. And also it was quite peaceful here. Peaceful here. Of course, he was Italian American. Well, that was... So when you say that I have trouble, the opposite. Mr. Channon addressed the people who had a were the sit-in in the Sheldonian, you remember. They took over the Sheldonian, saying, Wolfson is with you. Loud cheers. Wasn't authorized to say that, but one knew what he meant. I've never made no objection.
All right. Now, coming back again to the controversies and critics.
Oh, wait. Now, I have to tell you one little fact in addition to this. There was only one thing. The issue was about the opening of files. You see, the thing came from Warwick, and it spread to York. And the idea was that the students should be allowed to look at the files on them, because they alleged that when they applied for jobs at BBC, secret files were supplied, which prevented these people giving them jobs. So they demanded files, above all college files. College files didn't have this kind of information. These were university files. But they demanded that we should have no secret files of Wolfson. Now that led to a certain amount of disagreement among my colleagues. And in principle, I was probably against showing the files. But in fact, we succumbed. We said we had nothing to conceal. We didn't. Now files never contained anything against them. No, when they applied to the college, nobody ever said they're dangerous revolution. What the university collected, one doesn't know. So our files are open. They never looked. There's no trouble in that sort. On that subject, there was a sort of legitimate disagreement. That's the only reason why they shouldn't see them. I still don't. I was in favor, to some extent, of student democracy. I mean, because they didn't want to blow up the university. It wasn't like America. They didn't want to govern the university or to sit at college meetings or that. That was their need. Oh, very, very tame compared to other places. We never had serious trouble.
Was there a division here between the fellows and the dons, I mean, during this period? I mean, in America, there are some institutions...
No, on the whole not. No, we all went to a meeting of heads of colleges, and we agreed that if this went too far, we would have to withdraw our labor. We'd have to close colleges, have a sit, and so on. No, there was a complete solidarity. Some people went beyond others. I mean, the person who was most hostile to them was Chester in Nuffield, who was 100% hatred of students outside Nuffield. The others are milder. No, there was no shot. The Abacac presided, it was all very mild.
That reminds me that I want to...
They created a student council, I think. Something like that. That was all what it was in the end.
Then, I think it was still Bullock that nominated Herbert. It was a Hart Commission.
Ah, that's right. No, Hart Commission. No. Hart was a man who wrote the brief report. And then the commission was set up under... The first complaints, for student complaints, was set up under, I think, Nicholas, who is the principal of Brazos, a lawyer. And it had on it Stewart at Wadham, and somebody else, with somebody from Economist from Keeble, who was married to Douglas Hume's daughter, whose name I can't remember. I think three. And the other were violent scenes. And they were attacked with great ferocity, particularly by the present Mrs. Lukes, who used obscene language, God knows what. She was a barrister. And they hired her. You see? And the lawyers could appear. And Stuart was very shaken. And then there was the Court of Appeal. The head of the Court of Appeal was Neil, the Warden of All Saints, who was, can't remember if he was warden already or not. But as Mrs. Lukes was a barrister and he was head of the Bar Association, whatever the bar is called, she suddenly became very mild. The last thing she wanted was... So it all evaporated. But there was a certain amount of... Yes.
During your life in Oxford...
We didn't shake the colleges. No.
It's really interesting. Now, during your,
people were not sent down. One was, I think, for hitting somebody. Perhaps one or two under it. There was no mass measure to take. Nobody suffered.
During your service in Oxford as a don, were you connected, were you involved in hot debates and arguments and controversies? I mean, academic topic?
No. Ferocious argument, no. No. Not to the university level, not the college level, no. I mean, the worst things I felt strongly about. But I've never been present at a violent exchange, or two parties who simply hated each other, couldn't speak to each other. I don't think that happens in Oxford. It happens in Cambridge, much more. Some of you more strongly. I'm trying to think what is the nearest to it.
I mean,
for example, Bhutto, the famous Bhutto. Well, I took no part in that. Mrs. Thatcher, I took no part in that. See, I mean, those were real rows.
But you had your strong feelings?
No.
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 In Buddha state?
No.
In
no. Okay. No. Mm-hmm. No, I was not indifferent. In the Buddha case, I was totally indifferent. I didn't mind the least. Although the chief anti-Buddha camp was in Bursi. But Mrs. Thatcher, no, because I took another mild view. I thought on the whole there was a case for giving her a degree because she was a Prime Minister. There was a case against it because of the terrible cuts. I thought if she lost, didn't get a degree, we would be made to suffer by some sort of conservative counter-onslaught. And we were. We must have lost about £10 million. Herbert Hart was the heart and head of the thing. Deeply involved. Deeply.
Now, did you argue?
He and his wife. Yes. He just thought I was being cynical and so on. I didn't argue against. I didn't say it was monstrous or wicked or wrong. I mean, he said I thought it was unwise.
But you had to go.
He took a... Yes, I didn't. On that day, there was a meeting of the quite serious issues that arose in the Board of Covent Garden. So Klaus Moser and I did not attend congregation on that Tuesday afternoon, but we had the news, he got the news conveyed in the middle of our meeting about the defeat. He was very excited. I wasn't. I didn't mind. Now, I can't say that was strong. I thought there's no real issue. You see, Herbert thought that if we defeated her, a lot of other universities would feel that Oxford is not elitist, that if we did it, others would do it too. And moreover, that people were so shaken that it would in fact increase the grants. The exact opposite happened. No other university took the slightest notice. It became a piece of front page news. That a king country, I mean. That's not a matter. You see, even in Israel. You see, but everything Herbert thought turned out to be totally false. He has no political wisdom whatever about the affairs. No savoir-faire. He's not, he's got no political sense, funnily enough. She's, of course, fanatical in a kind of sweet way. But I'm very fond of her, always have been. But he's fundamentally an academic.
I know.
He can't predict, he doesn't know what results of elections, he's got no idea. He's a Labour Party voter this day because Douglas Jay convinced him that the common market would be fatal to England, which has not turned out to be.
Now, were you involved in committees in the university, I mean, reforming the curriculum or arguing?
I wrote a letter to the Franks Commission about advocating certain changes which didn't happen. I had views. Yes. But never a member of a party which was advocating something. There were no parties.
We never discussed it, but my impression is that you were more modern in your attitudes toward university life than the majority of your...
I'm not sure. I'm not so sure. I was in favor of a tutorial system,
yes,
which is regarded as reactionary.
Yes.
With him? In also, what they do, there was a row about how to spend our money. When there was we had a vote to take graduate students, and then that was vote against it. That was a real controversy. A fairly passionate kind. And there I did take sides, yes. I'll tell you a typical one in which I took sides and we won very easily. I was on a thing called the Research Fellowships Committee then. Suddenly, Hicks, who was then Professor of Economics, discovered there was a huge unspent surplus, which was called a building fund. No building was contemplated. So it was a perfectly theoretical affair, which accumulated more and more money. Because the warden and bursar hated spending anything. So it was just a mechanical act of accumulation, again, for no purpose. Hickson made a fuss and said, we ought to spend this money. Sparrow was warden, above all didn't want to do anything. There was no change of any kind. So he tried to give the money away. Maybe St. Anthony's needs it. Maybe others. Why can't we get rid of it? I made a speech saying no college is worth existing if it hasn't got 14 things pressing for realization for which there isn't enough money. The idea of saying, well, God, what do with this money shows deep decadence, shows complete lack of understanding one's purpose. And we will spend the money on, we are a research college, at least that. And then we had a vote in which the vast majority voted, I made a speech, vast majority voted with us. There were three opponents only, Sparrow, Ernest Jacob, and Beloff. I think that was all. I think Beloff changed sides towards the end, and he was defeated. On that I felt quite strongly. It was I who wrote the original document protesting against this push on the warden's part to get rid of the money. Then, as I remember, the negotiations with Bill Deakin, who thought he could make money out of us, naturally. The idea was that we'd have joint scholarship, joint fellowships. That didn't work at all. Not what he wanted, he just wanted a grant. Then there was a similar thing. Yes, then we all voted to have graduate students. And then they all voted against it in the end. I wasn't here for that. No, the only time I felt very strongly was when we turned down a man called Kreisel, who is one of the world's leading mathematical logicians, and who is very contemptuous of people, rude, disagreeable, can be very haughty. And he was unfortunately made member of Common Room for a term and offended quite a lot of people. And although he came easily top in the recommendations of the Research Fellows Committee, he was turned down simply because people didn't like him. And I thought that was very bad for a research college. And it was part of the reason my going to Wolfson. I suddenly felt Wolfson's no good. What? The academic values were too weak. Too weak. They simply went according to personal taste. Although you can say small community, one disagreeable man, nevertheless, if we existed for research, here was a man who was on intellectual grounds impossible to turn down. Since then he's become a fellow of the Royal Society, although he's a logician. He's a pupil of Wittgenstein. He's an Austrian Jew.
Yes, well, that's what I had in mind when I was saying that you were more modern in your...
I was indignant. I thought also it behaved abominably. And I felt very alienated from it.
Yeah, but that's personal attitude, which is typical of you. You suffer the weaknesses of people more than others. But I think there is more to it. I think that when you came back in 45 or maybe even earlier, your ideal of the university was not the gentleman scholar and the classics. I mean, you were modern in this
society. Certainly. Yes.
And yes, certainly. We never discussed it, but that's my feeling, that's my impression.
I think most people in the philosophical faculty were.
Most
philosophers, yes. They didn't want gentleman scholars. There were such. But Wolfenden, who was then the head of the Wolfenden Commission, he was made a tutor in Magdalen simply to teach gentlemen. He was a very bad philosopher. But he was good with the rowing men. So, you see, there were certain appointments of that type. Gerald Addington, who was son of the headmaster of Eton, but a third in schools. He made a fellow of university college because he was so good with the boys. was good outsider, who was a deep contempt for the intellect. Not contempt, was rather nervous of it, didn't like it, had no sense for it. No, I don't know whether the old ideal of, yes, of sort of gentlemanly dons and young men who sort of told them all about everything which was in their minds and hearts, sort of paternalism. Yes, I don't think I ever fit into that, no. Partly because also I was not an undergraduate college.
And yet, on the other hand, you were against some subjects that are considered to be modern.
I still am.
And you don't like
I still
it.
Am.
From the social studies.
I still am.
And are you considered to be the enemy of social studies?
I'm sure. I don't think I'm very formidable. One don't think I was afraid of it, because I don't do anything about it. But certainly, I think there is some sense that, that I think they're no good.
But you wouldn't say it about economy.
No, economics not, no, because that's intellectually taxing in some way. I don't suppose that use is of great use, perhaps. But, no, economics has a discipline. It has some kind of, whereas the others are soft. Economics is partly because of for mathematical reasons, partly otherwise, has a fairly rigorous intellectual standard behind it. It can be done by very clever people. Sociology cannot be done by very clever people. It can't. There's no room for, you see, nor can political science. It cannot be done by very, it's not possible.